In Scotland, a cloudy start to the morning with extensive fog across eastern areas, so a murky start to the morning, and a slow-moving weather front will be bringing persistent outbreaks of rain with some mountain snow across the far north. There'll be showers at times across central and southern areas of Scotland and not a great deal of sunshine. Highs for Scotland around about 7 or 8 degrees. That's the latest weather. Mairead.
Thanks, Chris. Chris Fox there at the BBC Weather Centre. Now we begin a new book of the week, The Last Asylum by Barbara Taylor. And it's subtitled A Memoir of Madness in Our Times. Professionals prefer to use the politer term mental illness, but as an academic and historian, the author chooses her words carefully when telling the story of her own turmoil and how she entered it and travelled to its roots, eventually finding peace and stability. The reader is Maggie Steed.
November 2002. I put on a skirt and jacket and head up to Frean Barnet in the North London suburbs. Princess Park Manor is a palatial apartment complex on the south side of Frean High Street. The sharp-suited woman in the sales hut by the manor's front gate seems excited by my visit. Maybe sales have been slow. When I am out of sight of the hut, I leave the path and walk across the lawn to a door on the building's far right. The door opens into a sunny corridor with polished wooden floors. I climb to the first floor, onto a small landing with a numbered door. I go over to the door and stand there. Sounds from within? No, nothing. No footsteps. No cries, no rattle of keys. Silence. So have we really been exorcised then? Not even the echoes of our voices trapped in the walls? Surely the stench of our cigarettes, our endless cigarettes, must still be detectable. But all I can smell is fresh paint and floor polish. Princess Park Manor was my loony bin, my nut house. In the late 1980s, I spent nearly 8 months there. None of the sales literature mentions the manor's previous incarnation as Frean Hospital. Yet in its own way, it was top drawer, even then. Entering it for the first time in July 1988, I found myself in what had once been England's biggest and most advanced psychiatric institution, the Middlesex County Pauper Lunatic Asylum at Colney Hatch, or Colney Hatch, as Frean was universally known until the mid-20th century. Like nearly all of Britain's old asylums, the hospital was slated for closure. A few days after my admission, my friend, the historian Raphael Samuel, had come to visit me. He looked around the vast drab ward with undisguised fascination and embraced me. "Darling Barbara, what a privilege for you, as a historian, to be present at the demise of one of the last great Victorian institutions." His words both annoyed and amused me, but they lodged inside me, and this book is the result. 19th November 1977. I had stayed up too long and thought too much. That was what I told myself later. I had spent all day and all evening, as I spent nearly every day and evening, writing my doctoral thesis. At about 11, as I was contemplating bed, I had a good idea, a fantastic idea, an idea so wonderful that it made all my previous ideas seem thin and silly. Excited, I tested it. Would it hold up? I was sure that it would. It did. It became the basis of my first book. And my excitement became overwhelming. I lay awake all night, breathing fast, heart lurching. The sleepless night segued into a day of exhaustion and anxiety, followed by an endless stream of such nights and days. I had been an easy sleeper. Now insomnia was my bedfellow, and my anxiety levels climbed steadily. A lightless misery engulfed me. The world drained of warmth and colour. A cold blankness was everywhere. This went on and on, as, armed now with many good ideas, I continued to labour away on my thesis. In 1980, I landed my first academic job, teaching history in a small provincial college. It was a nice, friendly college, a good place to launch an academic career, but I could barely manage it. I dragged myself into classrooms, panting with fatigue and panic. 6 months in, I attended the oral examination for my PhD, returned home triumphant, and collapsed. I lay in bed, stupefied, my mind frozen in fathomless exhaustion, dark horrors moving beneath the ice. My throat closed up, my heart raced. Sleep, when it came, brought no relief. My GP, a medic of the pull-yourself-together school, prescribed sleeping pills. That helped little. Then one dawn, after yet another endless night, I downed several of these pills with a big slug of whiskey. The exhaustion lifted. I had found myself cure. Armed with booze and pills, I returned to work. The conversion of intolerable emotions into bodily symptoms is one of the mind's favourite tricks. Freud would have called me a hysteric, but this was 1981, when hysteria was long out of fashion, and before chronic fatigue syndrome had come on the scene. Had it been a few years later, I suspect my GP would have diagnosed CFS or ME. I can easily imagine myself settling into physical invalidism or experimenting with the endless remedies on offer to sufferers from these conditions. Instead, I turned to psychoanalysis, as much for its prestige value as from any optimism about its curative potential. The left-wing intelligentsia of 1980s London was infatuated with psychoanalysis. Hovering on the edge of this world, listening to people comparing analysts, swapping couch gossip, I yearned to join in. Or so I thought. My illness was surely just an alibi. Eventually, I found myself in front of Mrs. B., an elderly and very distinguished psychoanalyst who had agreed to see me for a diagnostic consultation. Sunshine flooded in through the windows, and I remember sitting on the floor with my head in her lap. I know I did nothing of the sort, but the memory persists. I don't think you want an interpretation. You will make a fool of yourself, and you will hate that. It will be very painful for you. I don't know what to do. I don't think you have any choice, do you? But it'll be very hard for you. A fortnight later, she wrote to me to tell me that Dr. V in Harley Street had agreed to see me. Harley Street? I was thrilled by the elite address, by the classiness of this new adventure. V was in his mid-40s, which seemed about right. Not old, but old enough to make me feel young enough to deserve looking after. A conventional suit, a neat Freudian beard. The Harley Street room was large and coolly hospitable, pale walls and carpet, leather sofa and chairs, a wooden desk in the style we used to call Scandinavian. In the corner, directly across from the door, was an executive-style reclining chair, and in front of it, a couch. The couch, which I ignored for 8 months. V was standing beside the recliner. He greeted me and waited to see where I would go. I walked across the room to the leather sofa, as far from the couch as I could get without actually climbing out the window. He sat in a chair across from me, a coffee table between us, and we began to talk. The couch was not mentioned, but my eyes kept drifting towards it.
So, what has brought you here?
I rattle out my recent history. It doesn't seem to add up to much. I have been making a fuss about nothing. I wait for him to tell me this. Sounds difficult. Sounds like you've really been struggling. I don't like his sympathetic tone. Is he mocking me? Oh, yeah. I guess so. Tell me about your background, your family, and so on. I had expected this. I had even rehearsed it a bit. I settled back and talked. He nodded occasionally, asked a few questions, commented on nothing. I talked some more. Once or twice he smiled at me, which made me nervous. We will need to stop soon. I am vaguely disappointed. Is that it? He tells me his fee, and I tell him what Mrs. B has said I should expect to pay, which is rather less. We talk money for a few minutes. I spend too much on things. What sorts of things? Oh, I don't know. Meals out, clothes. I spend too much on stuff like that. You need food and clothes. You work for your money. You should have enough for what you need. This remark disconcerts me, although I have no idea why. Eventually we strike a deal. He will see me for the fee Mrs. B had mentioned, so long as I agree to pay more when I start earning more. Okay, yes, that's fine. You sound quite sure you want to do this. Have I sounded sure? Am I sure? Do you think I should? Yes, I think I do. Oh, okay then. Yes, I mean, if that's okay with you. So now I was an analysand. How I loved that word. And for a few months I buzzed with my new status. My twice-weekly sessions excited me profoundly. Sitting across from V, I posed and preened and baited him. I felt like Kate Hepburn teasing Spencer Tracy. I felt gorgeous. To my friends, I seemed wild, manic. Goodness, Barbara, what's the matter with you? My friend Sally demanded, alarmed by my feverish talk and frantic energy. The come-down from this was excruciating. All my earlier symptoms returned, much intensified. My exhaustion thickened to the point where it became difficult to speak clearly. The world was unfocused, mushy. Anxiety roiled around inside me, occasionally sparking into terror. I took more pills, began to drink heavily, staggered along. My delightful sessions turned rancorous as I realized that my brilliant, charismatic analyst was, in fact, an incompetent oaf. He understood nothing, made stupidly inappropriate comments, wore prissy striped shirts with white collars. I arrived earlier and earlier for my sessions, trembling with anxiety that he might not be there, that my hostility might have killed him off. As my dependence increased, I became waspishly satirical, batting back every interpretation with snide retorts. During one particularly nasty session, after I had scornfully waved away a dream interpretation, V lost patience. "This is no game. Don't shout at me. I'm not shouting at you. I'm asking you to take yourself seriously." To take myself seriously. Now, there was a road to hell.
Maggie Steed was reading from The Last Asylum by Barbara Taylor. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production for BBC Radio 4. Now, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Tuesday the 18th of February. The general synopsis at 1800. Low Island, 996, expected northern 4th, 1001 by 1800 Tuesday. The area forecast for the next 24 hours. Viking, north at Sierra, south at Sierra. Variable 3 or 4, becoming easterly 4 or 5, occasionally 6, except in north at Sierra. Rain at times, moderate or good, occasionally poor. 40s Cromarty 4th, cyclonic 4 or 5, occasionally 6 in 40s and Cromarty. Rain or drizzle, moderate or poor, occasionally good. Tyne, Dogger, Fisher, German Bight, Humber, Thames. South, veering southwest 4 or 5, increasing 6 at times. Rain or